Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has considerable personal experience with and command of intelligence matters is our first guest. My friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, our Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs, Fred Flights. He is, as I suspect you know, a career intelligence professional with some 20 years of service in the Central Intelligence Agency, also service as John Bolton's Chief of Staff when John was an Undersecretary of State, and subsequently he served as a professional staff member under the great Chairman Pete Hoekstra of the House Intelligence Committee. It's always good to have him in the House, virtually at least. Fred Flights, welcome back. It's good to talk with you.
Hey, Frank, good to be here.
Well, we haven't had a chance to catch up on air since the president finally announced what he was going to do about the Obama bomb deal. A dangerous and growing national security fraud, of course, being the topic, the title of your most recent book. Fred, tell us what you made of the president's decision.
As your listeners know, the president has to certify this nuclear deal to Congress every 90 days. It's in the interest of the United States and that Iran is in compliance. He made that certification twice this year, but said last time in July he's not going to make it again because he doesn't think that this deal is in the interest of the U.S., and he thinks Iran is at least violating the spirit of the agreement. I think they're violating the letter of the agreement, but I don't want to get into that right now. So the president said on Friday he's not going to certify this agreement to Congress. He's sending the agreement to Congress to fix it, and he said in his speech that if it isn't fixed, he's going to withdraw. Now, that everybody knows. What people didn't know, and this is crucial, is that the president spoke to my former boss and friend, Ambassador John Bolton, Thursday afternoon before the speech, and they had a very crucial discussion about this agreement. And the president made key changes to his speech based on his discussion with Ambassador Bolton, the most important of which, he said, it is entirely up to the president as to whether he stays in this agreement and that he reserves the right to withdraw from this agreement. And basically he's saying to Congress and to U.S. diplomats and to Europe, you want to keep this agreement? You better make substantial changes to it or I'm going to withdraw.
Now, Fred Flights, when you say that the president is calling on Congress to make substantial changes to the agreement, how would that be done? Is that some sort of formal amendment of it by the Congress of the United States, or is that, you know, imposing new sanctions which might have that kind of effect? How would this actually be operationalized, as you understand it?
Well, Congress would have to pass legislation, and there's two things it can do. First of all, it can extend sanctions, reimpose sanctions that were lifted under the agreement. And under the Corker-Cardin Act, there's a provision for those sanctions to be passed on an expedited basis, but it would require a majority of votes. It couldn't be filibustered. The problem is, I'm afraid that I don't think there are enough moderate Republicans to vote for that. Congress also would have to pass legislation to fix the agreement, and that concerns uranium enrichment, the production of plutonium, the very short length of this agreement, the sunset clauses, ballistic missiles, sponsorship of terror, a variety of things, and inspections, very weak inspections, a variety of things that make this a very bad deal. Realistically, Frank, that's not going to happen. And even if Congress did pass it, which I think there's zero chance that will happen, Iran is not going to agree to that. However, the president's doing something Barack Obama refused to do. He's working with Congress, the co-equal branch of government, to tell them, let's work together on this. He's given them an opportunity to do their job. You may remember that Barack Obama went around Congress. He did not let the Senate ratify this agreement. Well, President Trump is giving Congress an opportunity to do the right thing.
Well, but again, as a practical matter, Fred Flights, if Congress is unwilling or unable, at least, to make changes in one or the other of the forms that you've just described, the president has said, you know, he's going to get out of the deal. That would seem then to be in the cards as a practical matter. Is that a fair reading of it as you see it?
Yes, and it's an interesting observation. I think he clearly indicated he's pulling out of the agreement unless it's fixed. However, there are members of his cabinet, including U.N. Ambassador Haley, as well as National Security Advisor McMaster, who are trying to say, we're not going to get out of the agreement. We're going to fix it. And they're not talking about what will happen if we don't fix it. It troubles me that there's members of the president's cabinet who are pushing a different policy. And Rex Tillerson is even worse. And we've talked about that on this show before, too.
Well, there's a lot of insubordinate subordinates, it seems. And I've been given to understand that the U.N. ambassador, Nikki Haley, had been rather robust, at least relative to some of these others, in making the case for the idea of changing course, shall we say, with respect to this deal. But if she's not prepared to have him actually get out from under it, that would be putting her in the camp of the folks who are part of the problem, not the solution, as far as I'm concerned.
Let me add this point. There are a group of former conservatives who think we can fix the deal. And I think they have talked a lot of Republicans into this idea that somehow, magically, a bill can pass, the deal will be fixed, and poof, we can stay in it. And it's just nonsense. That's not going to happen.
Fred, it's my reading that part of why this has proven persuasive to the president is that he was hearing from his subordinates, among others, that if he stayed in the deal, that would continue to have some effect on the Iranian nuclear activities and perhaps other activities. I did want to ask you, though, in a matter of hours after he took this step, essentially Iranian proxies invaded parts of the area that was on the cusp of becoming perhaps a sovereign Kurdistan. I think this is evidence of the kind of problem the president's been confronting in terms of bad advice from many of those around him. Because he's been led to believe, it would appear, that this government in Iraq is both unified and sovereign and friendly, rather than what it is, it seems to me, which is increasingly just a cat's paw for Iran and very dangerous at that. What are your thoughts?
That's exactly right. This is the Obama policy, the one Iraq policy, which is why the Obama administration was so reluctant to giving weapons to the Iraqi Kurds to fight ISIS. It was just so troubling because I mean, you know, Iraqi Kurds, I meet with some in Washington sometimes. They would plead with us, help us. We're fighting the enemy here. This is an Obama policy. I think the Iranians probably retaliated because of the president's speech. But there's another issue here. We have to have a policy of telling the Iraqi government to stop collaborating with the Iranians, to stop relying on Iranian-trained Shiite militias, which are responsible for the birth of ISIS in the first place. The Obama administration just didn't want to hear that, and I wish someone would get the message to the president. This is a very important initiative that he has to do, and I don't think his current advisors are going to go down this road.
I don't either, and this is why we've been arguing strenuously that he needs a new set of advisors, for sure. Fred Flights, in that regard, there does seem to be a certain reluctance, shall we say, on the part of John Kelly, the president's chief of staff, to make changes, even in the face of this overt insubordination on the part of, I would argue, both H.R. McMaster and Rex Tillerson. Do you see any sign that that is likely to change anytime soon?
Well, I've been talking to my friend Sebastian Gorka. He thinks this big change is coming. And Gorka and I believe that at the end of the year, the president is going to take an accounting of his staff and of the advice certain people gave him on who to hire and may make some key changes. I'm hopeful that that is true. And really, he can't do it soon enough.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, from Sebastian Gorka's lips to God's ears, as a matter of fact, as well, it's high time. And as you say, Fred Flights, on all of these issues, Iran, and Kurdistan, and so many others. He's been poorly served by the advice he's received, and it is time for a change. Thank you, my friend, for your time. It's always great to talk with you, and I appreciate so much what you do for all of us at the Center for Security Policy. I know you'll keep it up, and I know you'll come back to us again next week. Rowan Scarborough joins us next from the Washington Times. We'll talk about the idea of drafting women to serve in frontline combat positions. Who on earth cooked up that idea? That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are joined once again by one of my favorite national security reporters, Rowan Scarborough, who covers that beat for the Washington Times, has done so for decades with an extraordinarily high quality of reporting and investigative activity. It's always a delight to have him with us. He is, among other things, the author of two best-selling books, Rumsfeld's War, The Untold Story of America's Anti-Terrorist Commander, and Sabotage, America's Enemies Within the CIA. Rowan Scarborough, it's good to have you. Welcome back.
Hello, Frank. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, listen, I wanted to talk to you about a story that you wrote this week, Rowan, that really caught my attention. It's, as is the truth, the case with so many of the reporting focuses of your efforts, that it's not gotten nearly the attention I think it requires. There is something called the U.S. National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service that has been set in train by John McCain and others on the Hill with a staggeringly large budget. Give us a sense, Rowan, of what these folks are trying to do and what the implications might be, among other things, for America's women.
We came very close to including women in the current Selective Service registration requirement. There were actually last year enough votes to put it into the defense policy bill, enough Democrats and enough Republicans to say, hey, if women want equality, let's start making them at age 18 register with the Selective Service just like men do. Well, a compromise behind the scenes created the commission that you just referred to. So everything was put on hold on the women's vote. And just a couple of weeks ago, they swore in this 11-member commission, which is going to have 2 years to go around the country and gather information about one of the key questions will be, should we have a draft? And should Selective Service require women to join just like men? And one interesting side note, Frank, is that the president got to pick three people for this 11-member commission. Now, you would think Obama, since he was going out the door, would leave it to Trump, since Trump is the one who's going to have to receive this report in 2019 and act on it. Well, President Obama did not do that. A couple of days before inauguration of Trump, he appointed his three members, a transgender retired commander, someone very close to Ray Mabus, who was the very liberal Secretary of the Navy, and then a Democratic appointee to the Army.
And the thought, I mean, I just have to say, maybe I'm a throwback to an earlier age, but I find it hard to believe that American men and women, for that matter, are going to like the idea of forcing women into the military in the event a draft is, in fact, instituted. And that could mean, under present circumstances, as you've reported, Rowan Scarborough, putting them into frontline combat positions. I mean, are we really at that state in our evolution as a polity that that's what we think women should be forced to do?
Well, the commission may well come up with that recommendation. And of course, the problem is if you have a mass mobilization to create larger combat units, that's not going to work because you need vastly more men than you do women. So it would just create a nightmare of trying to screen out the very, very few women, I think, at this stage that could do ground combat. I mean, the ground combat units are now open to women, and you don't see some are making it, but you don't see hardly enough to even get to, you know, like 10% of what a typical unit needs. So mass mobilization of men and women is fraught with a bureaucratic nightmare, trying to screen out who can do it and who can't. I think the more likely outcome of this commission will be we don't need mass mobilization right now, but we might need targeted mobilization. And so let's look at what skill sets the military would need in time of an all-out war as opposed to these smaller wars we're fighting now.
Yeah. Well, you know, Rowan, you've been around a long time. You've studied these things closely. I'm just struck by what I think is a failure to really think about these problems in a realistic way. The idea that we're going to just need dentists and mathematicians and internet wizards, as I think you put it in your piece the other day in the Washington Times, is all well and good unless we actually need a draft in case of a very serious conflict in which we need large numbers of people to go up and fight our nation's enemies. And as you say, that idea that we're going to build in women into it, or we're going to so scope the draft that it's unable to respond to that need, is really alarming. Hey, Rowan, let me ask you about something else. I'm interested in what you're picking up from your sources in the Pentagon. Yesterday, of course, the city of Rafka fell to Allied forces. We're looking at a situation there where some are declaring victory over the Islamic State. Is that how you see it? Is that what your sources are telling you we should now expect? Or is this simply going to morph into something different and perhaps even more dangerous than what we saw in the caliphate?
Oh, I think the latter, Frank, very much so. I think that ISIL is a horribly vicious thinking enemy, and they are already spreading their reign of terror in Europe, in Asia, and in the Middle East. Look at the Sinai and look at Libya. I think this is phase two for ISIL, where they're now going to become a cyber global terror network that is going to use cybersecurity messaging and recruiting on social media to just continue to attack the West in particular and also in Asia. The MI5 had yesterday put out had very bleak statements in London about the number of attacks that they have foiled that nobody knows about, that they believe they stopped maybe to the point where they couldn't go in and seize people, but they believe they stopped them where they were perhaps a couple of months away from actually carrying out the attack. What is going on in Europe with the radical Muslim population is very discouraging. And some of these people in Syria are going to go back to Europe. There was a photo of all the prisoners that were taken in Raqqa, the ISIL prisoners. Where do we think they're going to go? I mean, I don't know any capacity in Syria to handle these people like war criminals, and I don't see Europe wanting to handle them as war criminals. And are they just going to eventually be absorbed back into the population so they can become jihadis again? Raqqa is a tactical victory. I mean, we took away one of their hubs, but they have hubs all over the world now.
They do indeed. And I fear that some of them are not just in Europe, but here in the United States as well. Lastly, and very quickly, Rowan Scarborough, let me ask you about readiness. Could you, in just a minute's time, give us a sense of how the United States military is trying to mend from the legacy of Barack Obama?
We're running out of bombs, for one thing. I mean, the Air Force has testified that they need more money to buy basic munitions because, you know, obviously we've been dropping them in Syria, Iraq, in Afghanistan, and sometimes in North Africa. Look at the accidents that we've had at sea in Asia. I mean, that is a prime example of sailors not being trained properly, especially in nighttime navigation in somewhat complicated waterways. And look at retention, recruiting, where it's getting more and more difficult to find qualified recruits. The number of millennials that want to join the military and that are qualified to join the military is shrinking. It's not getting larger. So President Obama did not leave a better military than he inherited, that's for sure.
Well, no, I've long thought it was a wrecking operation, actually, Rowan Scarborough, and your reporting at the Washington Times helps unfortunately document that reality. Thank you for what you do there. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon, Rowan. It's always great to talk with you. Next up, we will be speaking with John Solomon, another intrepid reporter, about some breaking news concerning Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, and Uranium One, a real case of Russian collusion. That and more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is very good to have with us John Solomon, one of the most prolific and, I think, effective reporters and, well, journalists generally of our time. He is these days working at The Hill. He is currently the executive vice president, specializing in the digital video space for The Hill newspaper. He has been very active in other capacities, though, including as an editor-in-chief at the Washington Times and more recently at Circa. John Solomon, you have been breaking news yourself fast and furiously, and I want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about your latest revelations about a scandal that has gone unaddressed for too long, certainly in official Washington, involving the Clintons and Uranium One. Remind us what's involved and where things stand right now.
Yeah, that's great. It is. Thank you, Frank, for having me on. So for a couple of years now, we've known that, thanks to the New York Times and investigative order, Peter Schweizer, that the Clintons accepted, Bill Clinton took $500,000 from a Russian bank, and his foundation collected millions in donations from people who were interested in a decision pending before his wife's State Department. And that was the approval of a sale of a uranium company that gave Moscow control of over 20% of the United States uranium reserves. Now, uranium is the material we use in nuclear weapons. It's also the material we use in our nuclear energy plants. And this was a controversial decision. But for 2 years, the Obama administration, who made it with Hillary Clinton's blessing, stated flatly that there was no national security reason to block that sale. And what we reported in the last 24 hours is that there was a very big national security concern. Beginning in 2009, an entire year before Obama approved the sale with Hillary Clinton's blessing, the FBI had gathered significant evidence that Russia's government-controlled nuclear industry was bribing officials in the United States, receiving kickback payments, engaging in a racketeering scheme and an extortion scheme. Those are all the words that the FBI and the Justice Department used in their documents.
Those are rather serious charges, I think.
Yeah. Oh, yes. This was a big, serious case. More than $2 million of bribe and kickback money was exchanged between just the Russians and one company that was in charge of driving and transporting all of the uranium in the United States that came in from Russia. That's a pretty sensitive job, moving uranium, as you know.
And John, there's some evidence that these funds were also implicating others in government as well. Is that right? Or other funds?
What the FBI's primary evidence was coming from an undercover witness. And he was inside the Russian nuclear industry. He was witnessing and hearing what was going on. And he witnessed conversations in which they talked about efforts to gain influence with the Clintons and with the Obama administration in hopes of expanding Vladimir Putin's nuclear sales to the United States. So he was in real time hearing these things. And one of the things he heard was a discussion to route a few million dollars of money to an entity in the United States that had a close relationship with the Clinton Foundation. So he was seeing that in real time.
Who was involved in the FBI and elsewhere in the Justice Department at that time in overseeing this investigative activity?
Yeah, great question, because two of the names are names we hear every day now. It's Rod Rosenstein, Donald Trump's current deputy attorney general and the man currently investigation of the Russia special inquiry. And then Andrew McCabe, the deputy director of the FBI, who has his own controversy. He was the man whose wife took $700,000 from a Clinton friend, Terry McAuliffe, to run for Virginia Senate back in 2015. When Andrew McCabe's office was overseeing two cases, one, the Clinton email case we all know about, and another probe that didn't go anywhere, but that was investigating Terry McAuliffe, the Virginia governor at the time. So two familiar names surface in this earlier case.
How this stinks to high heavens is it's hard to calculate. But let me ask you, John. So Rod Rosenstein, who was at that time, as I understand it, the U.S. attorney involved in this this investigation. And the then deputy and still deputy director of the FBI, Andrew McCabe, were aware of this activity.
Not only were they aware of it, they were supervising. They took credit and were the supervisory people at the Justice Department and FBI, respectively, for this case. And Rosenstein signs all the documents that ultimately end up in this case in the court. And Andrew McCabe takes credit for the case in one of the few press releases that were ever issued about this years later.
My point is simply that they can't say they were ignorant of what was going on here. They were deeply involved in it. What did they do with this information before this very substantial amount of very sensitive nuclear material was transferred to what is, I would argue, a hostile government?
Yeah, it's a great question, right? And Senator Charles Grassley has announced that he has launched an investigation to find out the answer. What did they do with this information? What we know right now is that the FBI had plenty of evidence of the criminality already by the fall of 2009 and the beginning of 2010, but they didn't indict anyone for four more years. They waited until 2014 for the Justice Department finally indicted somebody. And what happened was in between that gap, when the FBI found the criminality and when they finally brought it to light to the court, the Obama administration made a series of very important favorable decisions for Russia. One of those decisions was to approve the sale of uranium one, controlling 20% of America's supply, to Rosatom, the main nuclear agency, the very nuclear company that was engaged in the bribery scheme. And two, to give permission to Rosatom's Tenex arm here in the United States to sell more uranium to American nuclear plants, a big boon. Because if you buy this uranium, you still have to create a market for it and you have to be able to sell it. So Russia buys the uranium assets and now they get a chance to sell more of it to the United States. All that occurred while the Justice Department had not disclosed this stuff, at least in court. So the question is, who knew what when? That's always the great question we knew. Now, we know one new thing that we're reporting this morning. This just broke a few minutes ago. We know that the undercover FBI witness tried to go public last year during the 2016 election. He tried to file a lawsuit against the Russians that would disclose the whole bribery scheme. He named 15 John Does, some of them who appear to be people that were in U.S. government or in U.S. positions, at least I should say. And as soon as he did, he received a call. His lawyer received a call threatening him that if he didn't withdraw the lawsuit and stop disclosing the information, that both his, quote, reputation and liberty, close quote, would be harmed by the Justice Department.
By the Justice Department? I can see that coming from the Clinton campaign in a heartbeat. But from the Justice Department? This, of course, being Barack Obama's.
Yeah, right. So his lawyer's on the record, Victoria Tensing, a very well-respected lawyer from the days when you were in the Reagan administration. She represents this gentleman whose name has not been disclosed publicly. She says it, but more importantly, The Hill has obtained two emails from 2016 in which the man's lawyer at the time, the civil attorney who filed this action in federal court, actually recounts the exact words that the Justice Department used on the phone call with her, threatening her client and then telling her client, based on what they're saying, I think you should pull your lawsuit. I think you should just walk away from this and not take any risk. Now, that is a pretty extraordinary event. I've covered Washington a long time, never heard of a Justice Department official being accused of this. And so I suspect that this will be a new twist today that will you know, result in more questions. And Jeff Sessions is up on the Hill today. We'll see if Chuck Grassley and other senators question him. But there's a lot of new information coming to light that builds on the very good reporting that the New York Times and Peter Schweitzer did 2 years ago, puts in a lot more detail now.
Well, I want to salute you as well for your reporting on this, John Solomon, and we will be broadcasting this program after Jeff Sessions hopefully answers some of those questions, and that we'll see where, in fact, this trail leads. But it certainly reinforces a point that I know you and in your previous life, your colleague Sarah Carter have been all over, which is at the very moment that we're chasing around the will-o'-the-wisps of Russian collusion with the Trump campaign, subject of a special prosecutor by another of the characters who I think features in some of these dramas, Robert Mueller, we are watching studied indifference to a real scandal, real collusion with the Russians, and real national security implications. John, your reporting is extraordinarily appreciated by all of us, and I hope you'll come back to us with updates on it. I know you're doing your best to make sure that these things get the attention that they require, and it's, again, it's a real public service. Thank you for doing it at The Hill. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, we'll talk about this and more with Diana West, right ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit with Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist, a blogger par excellence at dianawest.net, and the author of two, count them, two best-selling books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. Diana West, it's good to have you. As always, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. Wonderful to be with you.
Well, I wanted to ask you first, Diana, you being a rather serious observer of, and, well, critic, properly, of communism, the fandango going on in Beijing at the moment, this spectacular celebration of the Chinese Communist Party in the course of its National People's Congress, I believe it's called, it is an affirmation of the kind of agenda that Xi Jinping, its dictator, and increasingly, I believe, its leader threatening the rest of the world is embarked upon. He'll get another five-year term out of this, presumably. But what did you make of what's this sort of classic communist drama and the extent to which it really speaks volumes about the fact that it is still very much a communist totalitarian operation in China?
Yes, well, it's a triumphal phase, certainly, and a very open phase. At the same time, we have the United States. We have the Chinese exile Guo Wengui, who is the billionaire and opponent of the communist regime, but what trying to speak out, but being shut down in various venues from the Hudson Institute. Now on YouTube, his YouTube account has been suspended. So it's not just the triumph of communism in China. We have to deal with its vectors inside the West, and this is what we're still not awake to.
Which brings me to a topic that I was just discussing with John Solomon, which is another example of, well, I don't know if it's communist activity, but certainly brought to us by people who have a long track record with communism, namely Vladimir Putin and his kleptocratic colleagues. Talk a little bit, Diana, about your thoughts on this Uranium One scandal. As you've pointed out, there is a considerable history here when it comes to American uranium, isn't there, the old Kremlin?
Yes, there is. And this case, which is quite jaw-dropping for revealing the extent to which the Obama Justice Department was aware, indeed was investigating, kickbacks, bribery, extortion, and so on by the Russians inside a nuclear trucking company in the United States with presumably, we are being told, ties to the entire run-up to the approval of the Uranium One sale of 20% of U.S. stocks that Secretary of State Clinton, among other officials, signed off on. And as long ago, Peter Schweitzer reported that we saw over $145 million of various executives from that company contributing money over time into the Clinton Foundation. So we still have this morass. This is another layer of corruption given the Justice Department involvement, the FBI involvement, Mueller is involved, others. I mean, the corruption is intense. The collusion is intense.
As you say, it's an ongoing story because these people have either remained in their previous positions or being given new ones. But here we have a glaring, flashing red light saying there's a problem with the Clinton team. As we speak, the Attorney General of the United States, Jeff Sessions, is poised to speak to the Senate Judiciary Committee. I'm told that he will be addressing this. Of course, our program will air after all that happens, and we'll be able to discuss it further subsequently. But I very much hope that he will acknowledge there's a problem here and that it does require much more close examination and investigation. You have some concerns, though, about the failure of the Trump Justice Department to date to continue pursuing prosecution of some other examples of wrongdoing, reminiscent of the Eric Holder and Barack Obama Justice Departments of yore. What's going on here?
Well, this is really the great crashing disappointment, and I think ultimately, if it is not rectified, the destruction of the Trump enterprise in terms of draining the swamp. Draining the swamp is another way of saying restoring the rule of law, and the epicenter of any such movement, which is absolutely needed to save the republic. I mean, this is very dire, begins at the Justice Department. And we have an attorney general who went into office recusing himself from some of the main investigations related to not only the Russia investigation related to his boss, the president, but also recusing himself on any matters having to do with the Clintons. Given that the Clintons formed the living epicenter of American corruption made manifest, this is a problem when the rest of the Justice Department is part of the Clinton machine in terms of what we can measure in the failure to examine the pay-to-play Clinton Foundation, State Department, the email scandal, going back to what we know has not been done regarding Benghazi, going back to Eric Holder's Fast and Furious. I mean, you can go on and have absolutely any number of either independent counsels or certainly divisions of the Justice Department involved in trying to rectify the takeover of the government for high officials. And it's of both parties. We have two laws here. If the Clintons are not prosecuted, are not investigated, that means that the law does not apply to them. And this cannot stand if we are to have anything like a healthy republic. And the great disappointment and shock is not seeing the Trump Justice Department take this on, because it should be the core of the administration. And indeed, what you see coming out of Judicial Watch is day after day fights in court against the Trump Justice Department, which is taking on the banner of withholding documents, of blocking investigations, whether it's Cheryl Atkinson of CBS trying to get her own documents, whether it's getting releases of the unmasking documents coming from Susan Rice in the Obama administration. The Trump Justice Department is now the obstacle, which means at this point we have to acknowledge the Trump Justice Department is protecting the swamp.
It does seem as though it's Obama's third term after all, and that's a shocking and deeply disappointing development. Don, let me quickly ask you about one other thing. There are increasing indications that on November 4th, a group called Refuse Fascism, which has explicitly been tied to the Revolutionary Communist Party in America, as well as other groups like Antifa and Black Lives Matter, is going to be engaging in violent activity in the streets of American cities, a number of them across the country. What are your thoughts, again, as a serious student of political warfare and the communists in particular, should we be taking steps now to assure that what seems to be incipient criminal activity, specifically, you know, inciting rioting, conspiring to incite rioting, for example, both of which are statutorily prohibited, are being ignored with impunity?
Yes, no, it's an absolutely glaring failure of our political leaders to investigate these kinds of groups, as was once done, once upon a time, by the House Un-American Activities and other investigatory bodies to establish what is going on with groups that are avowedly making war with our Constitution. I mean, we don't take to the streets in violence in this country lawfully. It is an unlawful act. It is not the way the democratic system is supposed to operate. This kind of promise of chaos and violence is threatening. It is certainly linked to these same groups that we can find that trace the provenance going back 100 years, whether it's the Revolutionary Communist Party today or the Workers' Party in the 1920s. These are the same kinds of groups that are avowedly revolutionary in the most stark and open terms. And people ignore this to our, you know, greatest detriment at our extreme peril.
Diana, this is the kind of extraordinarily important accounting that you have been doing, among other things, in your great book, American Betrayal, as well as your website, DianaWest.net. I hope our audience will check out both of them afresh. Diana, thank you. We have to leave it at that for the moment. Come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.